With that, it gives me great pleasure to announce and introduce our speaker for tonight, Alonzo B. You're up, Alonzo.
Hi, my name's Alonzo. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you all for having me here. I want to thank Debbie for asking me to do this. We talked a little earlier, and I told her I would love this to be in the hotel in the ballroom. Of course, if that was the situation, I wouldn't be here. I'd be off somewhere working. So it seems to have worked out the way it should. I want to thank the techies. I've been doing this ever since this pandemic started. What they've done with setting up these Zoom meetings and websites and keeping us connected through this is just incredible to me. And I love how it happened almost instantly. Like they just knew that we would need this. My sobriety date is March 15th, 1988. I've got 32 years. And I can definitely tell you that if the pandemic had hit in March of 88 and my sobriety depended on me getting to pay phones and calling people, it never would have happened. So I guess we're lucky to have this. And kudos to the newcomers who are doing this without the live meetings that, you know, that we're used to, that we normally have, because that made a huge difference to me in the beginning. So, I definitely wanted to acknowledge those people and the people who put together the virtual convention and everything else. And I will tell you, through this pandemic, there have been two principles, ideas, whatever, two parts of the program that have kept me going and that have mattered to me. The first one is being powerless, because we are in a worldwide pandemic and we're all in it and we all have to deal with it, whether it be work or unable to go places, loss of income. It's a bunch of different problems that we're all having. And I have to remember I'm powerless over that. I have to accept it as the way it is. I could get mad. I could complain. I could cry about 100 different things. None of that would change this. And I'm so glad that I have the program to teach me that. And for the most part, I stay in that and kind of accept it and roll with the punches as best I can. The other thing is one day at a time. And that has been huge for me. It's not good for me to project into the future. When I project into the future, it never ends well. I've never been one to say, you know, 6 months or a year, 5 years from now, things are going to be great. No, if I project into the future, it's going to be over. And I had a specific experience that reminded me of this. Now, I'm talking a little about today, and don't worry, I'm going to go back and go into what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. But I feel like today is such a big deal because we're in such an unusual circumstance that I need to acknowledge it. So May of last year, it was interesting. So we're a month into the shutdown. I find out that the work I do, that there's a gig I do the beginning of every year, it was being shut down. I would be working it right now, but that's when I got informed that would be shut down for 2021. And then I have an apartment in my house that I rent out, and the tenants had an accident and they were going to have to move. So in my head, I put together the loss of income and the loss of a renter and calculated that I should be homeless by September of 2021. I pretty much got it right down to that month. And I called my accountant and talked to her about it. And she's in the program also, but she was laughing. And she was like, you're okay. You're going to be okay. First of all, you're lucky enough to have some money in the bank. Second of all, what about the program? What about living in today? What about God taking care of you, et cetera, et cetera. And like so many other problems, we ended up laughing about it. And that's when I knew I was over it. And that was a big reminder that I have to stay in today. I have to do this one day at a time. I can't tell you what's going to happen. I don't think anyone can. And I'm thankful to have this program to get me through it, you know. I will tell you right now that AA, I describe it as the background music to everything in my life. AA is always there. I can trace any and everything in my life back to AA. And I'm fortunate that I've reached the point where I work the program and the program works me. And I know a lot of you know exactly what I mean by that. I believe a lot of it just comes from repetition. There's an incredible amount of repetition in here. I joke with newcomers that it's not that I'm better at this than you. It's not that, it's just that I've heard it more. I've done it over and over. I mean, I've been sober 32 years. You know how many times I've heard how it works? So if you ask me how it works, like, yeah, I know how it works because, you know, they've pounded into my head literally thousands of times. And if you've got 30 days and I've got 32 years, then yeah, I probably know more about it. Doesn't make me any better, any more spiritual, anything like that. We're all sober one day at a time, but I have more experience with this working. And that makes it easier for me to believe in it and makes it easier for me to share it because I've had these experiences, you know. It's fun. This is, it's funny to me speaking tonight. There, I have to shout out these guys and get them out of the way right away. I have a group of friends, one of whom is my sponsor, it's four of us. And we meet randomly. Well, we put together a Zoom and we talk about it. And we talk about who's in the barrel, who's going through something, who's got to talk, who's this or that, the other. And I just want to let you all know that they are on another screen right now, on a text chain, judging everything I say. So I will be checked for accuracy. They will be keeping time, and they just love anything possible to go wrong. So I'm going to just share that with you because, once again, it's the laughter. It's the laughter, man. We laugh. We laugh hard at and when you got a problem, we laugh about it. You know, when I came here, I will tell you this, the guys who I was introduced to laughed at me until I could laugh at myself, and they absolutely changed my life. I grew up in New York. I grew up in Queens. Started getting loaded when I was about 13 because the older guys did it and they were cool and I wanted to be like them. And I took to it right away. It worked. I can't tell you exactly what it was, but I will tell you that not only did I like it, I always liked getting loaded alone. That was, you know, in those questions about, are you an alcoholic? They're like, do you drink alone? It's like, yes, it's my favorite way to get loaded. I don't like sharing. I don't like being around other people. And I'll talk to you about that. Everything I'll tell you about me are things I've learned about me in this program through the inventory process. But anyway, back then, my favorite thing was to walk the dog late at night, smoke a joint and drink a beer, as a guy who I briefly sponsored used to say, to relieve the everyday tensions of a 14-year-old. And I was, like many alcoholics, an overachiever. I went to a school called Aviation High School in New York. Besides the regular high school curriculum, they trained us to be airplane mechanics. And I was good. I was great in school. And I did great. And I graduated from high school. I was hired by Lockheed Aircraft in Burbank. I moved to LA and started my adult life. And when I talk about the early years, that part of my life, I talk about it being a charmed life because it was. Things fell into place for me. Like I said, school went good, graduated, got a great job, started accumulating all the stuff, got the apartment, got the car, got the motorcycle, et cetera, getting promotions at work. Everything's going good. Getting loaded was just part of it. It was fun. It was fun. It was drinking. It was 1980. You know, cocaine was involved. It was that fun little gram, half gram, whatever, on the weekends. And to those of you looking, I can't look at all the screens. I see it's up to 30 screens. But I know for a fact there are those who are around in the 80s. And you remember, they said cocaine wasn't even addicting. So that had to be okay, right? And it's part of my story. It's part of my story. And I don't separate drugs and alcohol in my story. When I got sober at a place called Studio 12. And the people who went there, what I noticed, they had all kind of meetings. They had AA meetings, CA meetings, occasional NA meetings. And I noticed it was always the same people at all the meetings. And they taught me that it wasn't the substance. It was the escape from reality. It was the escape from feelings. It was everything behind the substance was my problem. The substance was just a choice. So when I talk about this, I don't talk about it with any disrespect to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just telling you what my story is. And my story was a smorgasbord of drugs and alcohol designed to escape feeling. That was my goal. As I said, early in life, these things are falling into place. After a couple of years, I decided I needed her. That was the next thing I needed. I needed her. And I met this woman, looked like her, felt like her, sounded like her. Wasn't her, wasn't even close to her. But at the time, it was her. And I met her. I basically intercepted her as she came into the building to see another guy. She never made it past me. We ended up talking by the end of that month. We were living together. And 6 months later, things started to go wrong. And that's significant to me in the sense that things had never gone wrong, so I had never learned to deal with things going wrong. When I went to high school, aviation was an all-boys school. So I never went through the high school relationships, the girlfriends, the breakups, the this and that. I'd never gone through that. I didn't know how to do that. First thing that happened was I got laid off. I hadn't been out of work since I'd been like 16 in high school, and I panicked. It was very scary to lose my job. But what I found out was because of my training and experience and licenses, etc., I was highly employable. I found another job in a couple of weeks. And in my mind, that told me losing a job wouldn't be a problem. The next thing that happened was she left. I had a job in Santa Barbara. I would go up there during the week, come back on the weekends, and I came back one weekend and she was gone. And everything was gone. And it was devastating. It was devastating. I had never felt any pain like that. And the only thing I wanted to do at that point was not feel. I just didn't want to feel. And, you know, the beginning of chapter 3 in the book, I like it because I call it the deals. That's where we make the deals. You know, I'm not going to drink on the job. I'm going to drink beer and wine, not whiskey, whatever. And I had those deals. And at this point, all those deals went out the window because the only thing that mattered was I didn't want to feel. So the idea of I'm not going to get loaded at work. Yes, I am. I'm going to pay the bills first. I don't care about the bills. I want to not feel. And that was what I did. And that's how I lived. And my friend Ava, who is in here somewhere, she will remember those days because she was my lifeline. I started doing geographics. For those who don't know, a geographic is when I move to get away from the problem, never even considering the fact I am the problem. So I started bouncing around the country doing these different aerospace jobs, and my mail went to her house, and I'd sleep on her couch between jobs and so on. And I love her. It's more than a sister. It's an amazing relationship we have to this day. But she knows that back then, that's how I lived. And let me tell you something. Again, like everything else, it worked until it stopped working. You know, there was one job that I always want to remember, and that was Puerto Rico. We were rebuilding a DC-10 in San Juan. It was literally champagne, cocaine, and cash. We stayed at a condo on the beach. I was dating showgirls from the hotel next to us. Money was flowing. I was getting paid well. I was a lead man. And I led that double life. I absolutely led that double life that we as alcoholics master. You know, whenever I hear that thing about don't tell a lie because you won't remember what lie you told to who, I'm like, really? Really? Have you ever talked to an alcoholic? Because I think the average alcoholic can maintain at least 4 different lives at any given time and never mix them up. And my first sponsor, he talked to me about that. He said, well, of course you could do that because that was your survival mechanism. That's what you needed to do to keep getting loaded, to keep living the way you were living. So at work during the day, I was a golden boy. I was a lead man. I was this young guy who was really sharp and so on and so forth. I was trusted with the money for my crew. There was a problem in Puerto Rico with the bank. The bank didn't really understand why all these guys were here cashing these paychecks every week. So they made this deal with the bank that the lead of every crew would cash all the checks for his crew and then give out the money. And I did that, and I could absolutely be trusted. I didn't steal a penny. I didn't have to, because the other thing I was doing when we were off work was I was the cocaine connection for the crew. Simply because we went to San Juan. Now, the company was based in California. And I guess being from California, they didn't know Puerto Ricans, right? This is in the early 80s. So we get there, we get to the job, and they have a map on the wall of San Juan. And they marked out these red areas. And they were like, don't go to these areas, it's very dangerous. And I'm thinking, thank you for mapping it out, because now I don't have to search. I know exactly where to go, because I grew up in New York. And if there's one thing I'm not afraid of, it's Puerto Ricans. I've been around a few of them, right? So now I become the connection for the crew, and I'm shuffling all this, living this life. It's a ton of fun. Mind you, I'm making great money. I don't even have a bank account in my name. I don't save a penny. It all goes through blah, blah, blah. The reason I always want to remember that is because about 9 months later, I'm on a job in Oakland, and it's not champagne, cocaine, and cash anymore. It's struggling week to week. It's trying to maintain going to work and hoping that I'm fooling those people, and it's scrambling around looking for that peace, looking for whatever to escape my reality. See, and when it got that bad, and when I'm crawling on the rug looking for it, it never got good again. It didn't go back to what it had been. I just bounced one more. I went down to Dallas, hit another bottom there, ended up back in LA at my original job at Lockheed. And at this point, basically I'm working, but I'm not really doing anything. And beyond, my life was $20 at a time. That was my life. That's what I was interested in. I was interested in the next drink, the next hit, the next whatever, because that's what I needed. I went to the employee assistance program because I was going to get fired. I was going to get fired for missing work on Fridays. And I was like, listen, at this point, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a crackhead. You can't pay a crackhead on Thursday if you're open on Friday. That's not even my fault. What the hell? What's wrong with you? And I joke about it and I laugh about it today. But at the time, every week, I wasn't going to do it again. I'm not going to do it again. And the moment I got that paycheck on Thursday, I went into autopilot. I went to the credit union, cashed a check. I went to the liquor store. I bought a bottle. I went and got the dope. I locked myself in the apartment and I was there until I heard the birds. Because when I heard the birds, then I knew I just did it again. And it was a miserable existence. And the worst part about it is drinking and not getting drunk, using and not getting high, just consuming because I had to, because I didn't know what else to do. So I go to this employee assistance program and they send me to an outpatient place and they said, listen, you got to give up drugs and alcohol, et cetera. And I'm like, well, you don't understand. I got a minor problem smoking cocaine. Now, other than that, I'm good. I'll handle the rest. And they were like, no. And I lasted 2 weeks because I wasn't there to get sober. I was there to keep a job. And it was Christmas week. The company shut down. I don't have to stay sober if we're not working, blah, blah, blah. I went on another run. I got laid off. It was always better to be laid off than fired, because now my record's clear and I can still get another job and continue. And that's what I was about to do. And I got busted. I got arrested. And I had been incredibly lucky. That had never happened before. And when they put the handcuffs on and put me in the back of the police car, I remembered that word powerless, because you guys had told me I was powerless. And I had no comprehension of what that meant. I was a big, angry, intimidating presence. And the idea of being powerless never occurred to me. But when I was in the back of the police car wearing handcuffs, I knew in that moment whatever was going to happen had nothing to do with me. And I spent that night in jail alone with myself. And I had no one to blame and no one else to look at. I had to look at the fact that this is what I had done with my life and this is where I was. And I got out of jail the next day. It was a Sunday. I got drunk because I didn't know what else to do. And the following day, on Monday, I went back to the outpatient place and I talked my way back in. And I've been sober ever since. And I attribute that to willingness. I attribute it to it because I never wanted to feel the way I had felt that night in jail again. And I was willing to do whatever you guys said to not feel that way again. And miraculously, you guys had all changed while I was on that last run, because suddenly you knew what you were talking about. And suddenly I was ready to listen to you. And what you said made sense. And I was that guy in the rehab that nobody likes because I was anxious to be there. And if they told me to read it, I read it. And if they told me to write it, I wrote it. And a panel came in and there was this beautiful woman on the panel. I can't tell you one word she said, but I tell you, she was from New York. I was from New York. I had days, maybe even weeks of sobriety. And I made my move. At the end of the meeting, I was, and she was like, listen, I'm married, but there are a lot of women like me that go to a place called Studio 12. And in my mind, I was like, I don't know where it is, but that's going to be my home group. And she took me to Studio 12 and she introduced me to a group of guys. And they said, sit down, shut up and listen. You're a newcomer. You don't know nothing. You start the lie, we can finish it. We don't want to hear anything you have to say. You do what we tell you to do. I love those guys. My sponsor today is one of the guys from back then. I have learned in my 32 years, there's as many ways to get sober as there are people at this meeting. There's that way, there's a disciplined way, there's loving, there's educational, there's hand-holding, there's all kinds of ways. I needed that. I needed these guys because they saw right through me and they didn't worry about my feelings when they told me stuff. And like I said, if I had a problem, they found it absolutely hilarious. I came in, I was on an eviction notice. I had one of those 3-day or quit notices and I was like, man, I'm going to lose my home. And they were like, good, you ain't got nowhere else to go but meetings. You'll have more time. You can make more meetings that way. Everything I said to them, they had a quick response for it. And I love that because I'm a words guy. I love to read. When they told me to read the book, I read the book in like 4 days. And what stayed with me about the book was like, how did these white guys 50 years ago know exactly how I feel today? And that made a difference. And these guys would tell me what to do and they would never tell me why. They just told me to do it. And I'd learned a lesson on the backside, you know. I was at a meeting. It was a Saturday night meeting. And I was getting a cup of coffee. And they said, you're the new coffee person. And I was like, yeah, you don't understand. First of all, I don't know how to make coffee. Second of all, I got other things to do on Saturday night. And they said, what you got to do on Saturday night is be here an hour early because the coffee better be ready when we get here. Okay, we know how alcoholics are about coffee. It's funny, you can screw up any other commitment, right? You can be a secretary with no leader. You can be a treasurer and steal the money. But if you are the coffee person and you don't show up, we will talk about you like a dog. It's just one of those things. I learned that real quick, by the way. What they didn't tell me about that coffee commitment was that because it was a book study, in the 6 months of my commitment, I would go through the first 164 pages of the book. And because I had to be there an hour early, I had to meet people. I had to talk to people. And I had to get, today they would say, get out of my comfort zone. Because I didn't like people. See, here was my thing with people. I figured that you didn't like me, so it was easier to push you away first. If I had something to do, this got me through school and jobs and everything else. So I was like, tell me what you want me to do so I can do it and you will leave me alone. Because my goal was always to be left alone. That's where I wanted to be. And they didn't allow that. I had to be at that meeting. And I want to thank the women of AA. There's a debt I owe to the women of AA that I'll never be able to repay, and I want to acknowledge it because it was the women of AA who taught me and allowed me to feel. When I got here, I basically had two emotions. I was angry or I was okay. And it was the women who weren't afraid of me, who let me know when I had other emotions, when I was sad or afraid or what, who hugged me, who loved, when we talk about love you until you can love yourself, that's what they did. And it was a softness that I needed, because I am to this day very guarded over my emotions. My friend Billy G, who cries like a baby, would be the first one to tell you that I'm not that guy. And he'll be so proud if I cry tonight while speaking. But the women loved me and they held me. And a lot of those women were still friends to this day. And I appreciate that. And I remember early on, there was one meeting I was at, and I was in that place where I'm not getting mine. It ain't happening fast enough and whatever else. And I was mad. And I was, the meetings were in a garage. You had to walk down the driveway to get to the garage. And I'm walking out of the driveway. I'm storming out of the driveway. And my friend Maxine grabbed me and she looked at me and she said, "What is wrong? What is wrong?" And she sat me down and she talked to me. Now, again, I can't tell you what she said, but I will tell you that I turned around and I went back down the driveway to the meeting. I was on my way out when she intercepted me. And my sponsor at the time, a guy named Patrick, he said, "Yeah, I saw you, but your ass was too big and too mad. I wasn't getting in the way of you, you know." That was the kind of love I got early on. The lessons I got early on, they kept it simple and they gave me things I couldn't argue with. And I'll tell you how important these things were. I still remember them to this day. That's how much of an impact those things had. I remember I asked Patrick, my sponsor, I said, "How come you never call me?" He said, "'Cause I don't want what you have." That was it. I couldn't argue with that. I remember this guy, Mike, said, "You know, we always talk about being fearless. We're going to be fearless." He said, "Nah, it's impossible." So you can't be fearless. What you have to learn is you have to learn how to do it scared. I've done it scared 1,000 times. I've done it scared all through my sobriety in 1,000,000 different occasions because I learned you have to do it scared. I remember one day this guy, Marty, a lot of you know Marty. Marty passed away last year with 50-something years sobriety. And Marty, he asked, "How you doing, kid?" And I was like, "Man, I feel like killing myself." And he said, "Congratulations. You didn't even think about getting loaded. You went straight to suicide." And I felt better. And I see some of you laughing about that. And the reason I always tell that story and the reason I always want to remember that story, because to me, that is the epitome of one alcoholic talking to another. That's how we understand. Because if you talk to a mental health professional, and I believe in them, and I've been in therapy in various times in my sobriety, I definitely believe in outside help. But this is one of those things that if you talk to anyone in the mental health world and you say, "I'm thinking about killing myself," red lights go off and they want to tie you down and send you to a facility and this and that and the other. And you tell an alcoholic you feel like killing yourself and they congratulate you on not drinking, because an alcoholic understands. I've been to meetings all over the world, and I love LA. I love Southern California because we have a lot of fun. And one thing you'll know about Californians, if you go to other meetings, is they always can tell a Californian because we applaud. When someone finishes, we clap and then we look around and nobody else is clapping. And somebody asked me once about the applause. And you know what the applause is? The applause is our way of saying we understand. I always tell people AA is the only place you'll get a round of applause for doing your laundry. And the reason is we understand how hard it is to have a pocket full of change and go to a washing machine rather than a bottle. We understand that. So I appreciated stuff like that. And I had heroes when I was new. And one of my heroes was a guy named Charles. Charles was a brother. He was about, I don't know how much older than me, but he was older than me. He was the coolest guy I ever met. Charles used to, he was a wardrobe designer. He would always be dressed impeccably. They used to say when Charles walks in, he's so cool, the temperature drops. I love Charles. And I know we're not supposed to have heroes in this and that, but we do. And he was one of mine. I remember being at a meeting and Charles said, "Man, that sweater looks good." And you got to understand, as a newcomer, hearing that from Charles is the greatest compliment I could give you. "Man, that sweater looks good." He said, "You probably picked it out by accident because you're just a newcomer, but you got it right that time," because they would build you up and cut you down and we would laugh. And So I'll tell you this story about, I'm jumping ahead, but I will tell you this story about Charles. Charles used to say, you know, I'm a three-time felon and I got the keys. Because he was, I think he was working at Warner Brothers or one of the studios, and he had the keys to their clothing closet, which is like a giant building full of all these costumes and clothing. He said, I got the keys. Years later, I'm jumping ahead in my sobriety and I'll fill it in, but I was working as a driver for a TV show, and the producer on the show trusted me. And whenever we would get an expensive vehicle, a specialized custom vehicle or whatever, he would give me the keys and tell me, keep an eye on it. And all I could think was, I got the keys. See, that's how this thing works. You know, I stayed sober and years later, I got the keys. I have a lot of experiences like that, full circle, where it was one way, I was on one end, and now I'm on the other end. My early sobriety, my sponsor took me through the steps. When I did my fifth step, I learned about honesty. That was huge. I got back to work in aerospace, and I ended up being a trainer, a teacher. I was training new airplane mechanics, and I was making them laugh. Now, I've always had a sense of humor. I've always been able to make people laugh, but it was always a tool of separation. I used it to deflect energy away from me, or I used it to belittle you or whatever. And like I said, these guys used to laugh at me all the time until I laughed at myself, and my sense of humor had changed. I remember in my fourth year of sobriety, a friend of mine, she said to me one day, she said, you know what? You're not angry anymore. And she was right. And now I'm teaching this class and I'm making them laugh. And I said, I want to be a comic. And my sponsor said, you could do it. And I said, how? And he said, I have no idea. He said, but if that's what you want to do, you can do it. And I took this comedy writing class and I did the 5-minute graduation show. And that guy, Charles, who I was talking about, he was there along with a bunch of other people supporting my sobriety. And I came off stage and Charles said, man, it looks like we found out what God meant for you to do. And that was absolutely the feeling I had, you know, and I feel lucky in that my miracle happened then. When we say don't leave before the miracle happens, I feel I'm lucky because I know when my miracle happened. I started doing comedy. I never looked back. I knew this is what I was going to do. Today, I live a dream I didn't have when I got here. That's the only way I can describe it. I didn't grow up wanting to do this. This isn't something that I thought about, whatever. I found this in sobriety. It has been the most incredible ride that I can imagine. I have achieved things. So I've been around the world numerous times. I've been on a bunch of different shows. I've met people I could go on and on just about that aspect of my life. I will tell you this. I'll tell you a few of the funnier highlights, the moments that I remember. I was in Oman, and we were doing a show at the embassy, and I met the U.S. ambassador to Oman. And all I was thinking in the back of my mind was, wow, I'm a crackhead. Sobriety taught me not to tell him that. A few years ago, for my mom's 80th birthday, my mom has since passed away, but I was doing a gig and I got to take her on this cruise through the Mediterranean, and I got to take my mom to see Europe. My mom had always wanted to see Europe. My dad wouldn't take her to Europe. She's like, why not? And he's like, I've been to Europe. And she was like, that was World War II. Because my mom was the funniest person I've ever known. She would always make me laugh. But I got to take her, and she got to see Europe, and it was fantastic. And these things are gifts to me, you know? You guys understand that. I'm okay today, you know, through all this pandemic and all of this, financially, I'm okay. You know, somebody pointed out to me, we're talking about a meeting that I will talk about material wealth or material success. And I do, but I never talk about it to brag. I talk about it to let you know that it's possible. I talk about it to let you know how incredible this can be. You know, someone said sometime, God's infinite gifts are not limited by my finite imagination. And I found that absolutely true in my life. I'm an alcoholic, which makes me a fatalist. So at 3 years sobriety, when I go through a bankruptcy, in my mind, I'm never going to have credit. I'm never going to buy a car. I'm never going to get a credit card. I'm never going to fill in the blank. I'm never going to do it. And I've achieved all of those things. And I have a home. And like I say, I have someone who rents from me. Now, remember, I came in on an eviction notice, and now I have someone who rents from me. See, that's AA, and that's what I talk about the full circle, about how things change. I have had cars and bikes and all that. We joke about them. We call them cash and prizes. And I got cash and prizes. And I've been taught, see, to me, there's no evil in material things. When people say, oh, material things don't matter. Whenever, if you're a newcomer, when someone says material things don't matter, ask for their car right then, right in that moment. Say, give me a car, because it doesn't matter to you, and I'm riding a damn bus. I have learned material things are nice, but they are far from the most important thing. They're not. They're just nice to have. I'm a car and motorcycle nut. My sponsor's a car nut. And there was a period where work was slow. It was oddly slow for both of us at the same time. And I watched him, and he sold some of his cars and stuff. And I never heard him complain. I never heard him blame anyone. And he was like, you know, when things are good, you have them. When things get slow, you let them go. And that, he, one more time in AA, he taught me by doing. Not by saying, but by doing. Now, Daryl's been my sponsor for the past 22 years. And Daryl has always let me know that I will forever be one notch below him on the scale. When I came in, Daryl likes Porsches. Those are his cars he likes. It's no secret. Anyone who knows him knows that. And I love Porsches. And I said, Daryl, I'm going to get a Porsche one day. And he said, yeah, and I want to be tall and thin one day. We don't always get what we want. And at 9 years of sobriety, I drove up to a meeting in a Porsche. And Daryl was there in a Ferrari to remind me that I will always be one step lower. And we laugh about that. And we laugh about things like that because it keeps those things in perspective. So I consider myself very blessed with those things. I'm very grateful for them. If you're new here, all I can tell you is one day at a time, it changed. Things that were never going to happen happened because I stayed sober. I've seen so many people leave before it could happen. I wish I could tell you when it's going to happen for you or what it's going to be. I can't. But I can tell you that if you stay, it will happen. And things have happened in my life that I never dreamed of. I talked to you about the gifts. The gifts of sobriety are things like, I talked to you about my friend Ava, and I watched her get married, and I was at her wedding, and I was there when her daughters were born, and I've watched her little girls become women, and I've been part of that whole thing, and I absolutely love that. I absolutely love being an uncle, because I'm that uncle, and I get to have those experiences, and I get to do things, you know. Girls have this scream that they, when they're happy, I've done the things for my nieces that have gotten the scream. And I remember my niece Alyssa, her favorite comic was a guy named Eddie Izzard. And I was working with Eddie and I said, hey man, my niece really loves you. Will you make a video? And he made a little video. He said, hi, you know, and I'm with your uncle. He's really funny. We wish you were here, blah, blah, blah. And she got the video and she played it and she just did the stuff. Uncle Lonzo, Eddie Izzard said hi to me and I don't even have cancer, which I didn't know was required. But I got to experience that. And then, I'll go into another gift and I'll talk about the emotional sobriety. I know I got to wrap up soon. And that's the slowest area of growth. But I will tell you, my brother is here on one of these screens tonight. My brother and I, besides being brothers, he's one of my closest friends. And we've been sober together. It's really crazy. We came in December of 87. That was my first exposure to sobriety. And it was also his first exposure to sobriety. And I was in New York, in LA. He was in New York. We had never mentioned it, but we both went to rehab in the same month. And I ended up going out, like I said, and I came back in March. He went out, came back the following December. So I do have more time than my older brother, which is just a card I have to play every now and then just to let him know. About 7, almost 8 years ago, I donated a kidney to my brother. He had been going through some health problems, kind of degenerative kidney thing, and he was going to go on dialysis. And I said, hey, if I can give you one, I will. And they did the testing, and we were compatible, and I was able to do the kidney donation. And he's healthy today, and so am I. But we did it. And the way the surgery works, that I learned some things. One thing, they take the kidney out of me. There's one team that does that. Then there's another team that puts the kidney in him. What I didn't know was they don't remove his kidneys. They added mine. They added mine to his, so to increase his kidney function. So that night after the surgery, we're in the hospital and we're up. We can't sleep. We're walking around. He said, his doctor told him, man, you're going to be fine. That was a big ass kidney. He said, we actually had to make room to get that big ass kidney in you. And I joke about that. That was one of the gifts of sobriety. After 25 years, I had big ass kidneys, you know, because when I came in here, I had crack kidneys and they don't take those. And we were walking and talking. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking like, did he say thank you? You know, not that it was about me, but I'm thinking like, it's a kidney. You know, just say something. And we were in the hospital for a couple of days. Then we went to his house. He lives in Connecticut. And we did the surgery back there. And we had to hang around the house. It was almost like this pandemic lockdown, because he couldn't risk an infection. And I couldn't go out, because if I got sick and came home, he'd get sick, blah, blah, blah. And we're hanging out and nothing being said. Now, I got to tell you where we come from. We come from a family that does not express emotion. We don't say, I love you. It wasn't hug. Now, there was never a doubt my parents loved me. My parents took care of me. But there's a few people here who know my dad. And as unemotional as I am, I'm an emotional mess compared to my dad. Totally stoic. And it's where we come from. So I'm getting ready to fly back to LA. We got the final checkup, this and that. And my brother said to me, he said, words will never express how grateful I am for what you've done for me. And the reason that hit me is because I know where we come from. And I know how hard it is to express that kind of emotion with our history and our upbringing. And I felt it was just, this is where I talk about, when I say giving a kidney to him was a gift to me, you guys understand that. See, that's one alcoholic talking to another. I know you guys know what it means and how much that meant to me and how much I love my brother. My friend Kenny Bob, who again, a lot of you know, Kenny used to say that I don't have the script for my life, but the cast is fantastic. And that's how I can describe my life. I can tell you the cast is fantastic. I could tell you a million stories about a million people in here and why we're friends and how we love each other and what we've been through. My friend Billy, I'm gonna tell you when me and Billy bonded and how this laughter thing works. In my first few months, I was going to Men's Stag. It was a Monday night meeting, and it was a rowdy meeting, a lot of guys, and they would yell at you and they'd rip on you, and you couldn't raise your hand to share. You had to get picked to go up to the podium to share. And I got picked. And the night I got picked, that weekend, I don't know, I was definitely in my first 90 days. I had met this girl. This girl had come to a meeting. She was beautiful, and I had asked her out. And that was on Thursday. Let me back up, tell this story. So Friday, I go to pick her up. And I open the door, and she is stunning. I mean, I'm like, and she's like, I get that. Don't worry, you'll get used to it. She was a model. She's just absolutely beautiful. We go out, we have a good time, we're laughing. She was even like, I was like, I gotta go. She said, you wanna show me off to your friends, right? I said, yeah. She said, that's okay, we can do that, you know. So anyway, we go out, we have a good time. And, you know, in my head, I'm planning the wedding and everything else. And so Sunday, I call and she's not there. And they're like, oh, no, she got a job. She went back to Italy. I'm like, what? She went back to Italy. So now I'm crushed. So now I'm crushed. So Monday night, I go to this meeting and I get called on to share for the first time. And I'm telling these guys a story of my weekend heartbreak. And I'm like, and I can't drink. All I can do is drink Cokes and listen to Sade, you know. And they are laughing their ass off. I mean, they are pounding the floor laughing. And what happened was I became a part of that day. See, when they laughed at me like that, whereas before it would have made me mad, and you're picking on me, I laughed too. And I became a part of, and it made it just changed it for me. Now let's jump forward, and my friend Billy is at a meeting, and he's sharing, and it's heartfelt. It's about getting his wife back and his relationship with his kid, and he's crying, and the whole room is crying, and this and that. And I'm sitting behind him, and I just leaned forward and I whispered in his ear, "Man the F up," and he fell out laughing, and me and him have been just heartfelt friends ever since that day. See, because we got to laugh. We got to, that's why I talk about the laughter. Someone told me once that laughter is the music of AA. I guess it is. I don't know. But I feel so connected, you know. And I was talking with someone recently. I'm connected with the people I laugh with. And I have problems and I bring them to this program. And as I was once told, anything you can think of, someone in here has done. And we laugh, and we laugh about it, and it makes it okay. And I find out the most important thing, which I learned when I got here, is that I'm not the only one. That was huge. It was huge to find out I'm not the only one. You guys understand, you've been there, you've done it, you've gone through it. The slowest area of my growth has been emotional sobriety. Like I told you before, I'm not good at opening up with feelings. I'm certainly not good in relationships. I have a house today, and it's funny. So I love my house. I love my house. It's a little it's a house in the foothills, blah, blah, blah. My friend Ava, when I first came to this house, when I got this house, I drove her past it and she saw it and she started tearing up. Because she knew that I'd always dreamed of owning a house like this. I'd always dreamed of owning a modern style house in the foothills. I have the house that, according to tradition that I've heard in the AA, this is the house I'm supposed to get married to some woman and lose this house to her and somehow become more spiritual. Because I would always hear guys say, yeah, the house in the hills, and I lost that to my wife and this and that. So I guess I'm at that phase in my sobriety. But anyway, that all that to say that I'm not married and I don't know how to do that. At 10 years of sobriety, I got into a relationship situation where I was cheating on one girl with another girl and the whole thing was a mess. They're both in the same home group as I was. I do not recommend that to anybody. I love watching. So I'm watching one guy just shake his head and laugh. Said, judge me all you want. You'll do it one day. Anyway, it was bad. It was bad. And I asked Daryl to help me. And Daryl said, I'm glad you asked because you were on your way out. And he told me the reason you can't love anyone is because you've never learned to love yourself. You've never forgiven yourself. And he took me through the steps one more time with that in mind. He gave me one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do in sobriety. I had to do a positive inventory. I had to write down good things about myself because I'm one of those people that easily blames myself and has a really hard time crediting myself. And he gave me an exercise to write down the names of friends and write faults that they had. And then he said, how come you can accept them with their faults, but you can't accept yourself with any? Why is your ego such that you have to be perfect? And he taught me that all of that self-pity and self-hate was actually just another form of ego. And we worked on that. And like I say, I've worked with therapists and talked to people, and it's a slow area of growth, but it's an area I work on. I work on it. And recently I went through a relationship situation and a breakup. And the woman said that I'm not a good communicator. And I was outraged. How dare you say I'm not a good communicator? I communicate for a living. I communicate on stage. I've been on TV. I paid for my house with communicating, blah, 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 blah. And one more time, I sat down with my sponsor in my outrage. And he said, no, you're a good talker. Communication's about listening. And he stopped me right there. And I have to learn to listen. I have to learn to consciously focus on listening. And the most difficult part of that, which was pointed out to me by a woman, was you have to learn to listen to the feelings, not just the words. So it's one more time that I have to grow, that I have to change. My sobriety changes, my where I'm at in my sobriety, what I need to do, these things change. The one thing that stays constant is don't drink and use no matter what, one day at a time. And that sounds huge, and it was. When they told me in the beginning, no matter what, I didn't know what that meant. And then I watched people go through no matter what. And they told me simple things that I had never thought of. The first time someone said to me, you know, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. That was like a revelation to me. I had honestly had never thought of that. The idea of not drinking had never occurred to me. So that was a big thing. And they told me you got to stay sober one day at a time. And they didn't say you got to stay sober for a week or a month or a year. They said you just today. Just stay sober today. And, you know, I'm going to wrap up because I could go on telling you stories all night. But I will tell you this, something that I've learned in my experience in AA. If you're new here, everything you've heard about AA is true. Do we gossip? Yes. Do we fight? Yes. Inappropriate relationships on all levels, anything, any of that stuff that you've heard, if you're looking for that back door, that reason to not be here, to not trust us, whatever, you'll find it. Do we give advice on things we don't know about all the time? We will be happy to advise you on nuclear physics. You know, my first sponsor told me, he said, you got to get outside help. He said, listen, if you have a tax problem, do you want to go to an alcoholic or a cocaine addict? Who do you think's going to help you with your finance? We'll give you advice on things we've never done. All of that stuff. And I've experienced all of that. I've done the inappropriate relationships. I've had fights, verbal and physical. I once slapped the hell out of a guy after a meeting. I will still stand by the fact he needed it, but I have made amends because apparently it's not the behavior you're supposed to have. And it was funny because years and years later, this woman asked me to lead a meeting, and I was leading the meeting, and the guy was there, and I was telling the story, and she was like, wow, you really did smack him? I thought that was just an urban legend. And it was like, no, I smacked the shit out of him. All of that to say that we're humans, and we're not just humans, we're alcoholics, which means we're all self-centered and sensitive, and I can easily take something the wrong way. And like I said, I may not be listening because I'm only waiting to talk and this and that. And all of that stuff is true. But here's the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've experienced this and I absolutely believe this. And if you're new, I share this with you with all of my heart. And I want you to really just get it. We know how to stay sober one day at a time, no matter what. We do that better than anyone in the world. And if you come to us, if you take a chance on us, if you say, I don't know, I want to use, I'm scared, I can't make it, I need any form of that request, all that other bullshit drops away. And the most important thing becomes you staying sober one day. And we will literally talk to you, hang out with you. We will pass you from one to another. I've had experiences where we took the newcomer out, took him to a movie, and then 2 hours later, I got to go. So here's so-and-so, and he'll hang out with you, and then you go to coffee, and then you do this, and you do that, and we stay with you. We hold your hand. You get this, and you make it through that day, and then you make it through another day, and the days become weeks, and the weeks become months, and at some point, you get the miracle of AA. You get what I consider the truest, biggest gift of AA. Somebody will say, I need help, and you get to help them. You get to put your hand out. You get to share your experience. I've been on the other side of that. It is absolutely incredible. When I came in, I was 26, and there were guys and people at the meeting who had been sober longer than I had been alive. And that blows my mind. And now at 58, with 32 years, I speak at these young people things, and I've been sober longer than they've been alive. And they've done drugs that didn't exist when I was out there, and all of those things. And I get to talk with them, and I get to share with them, and I get to laugh with them. I get to laugh at them until they laugh at themselves, and then they know it's going to be all right. As I told you, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I could go on forever trying to tell you how much this has changed every aspect of my life. I've experienced just great highs and great lows. I've lost both my parents in sobriety. It was peaceful. I was able to be there and be a part of and get through it. I heard about my mother's cancer going from the abdomen to the brain, and I was on a cruise ship. And my only fear, my biggest fear, was what if I never get to laugh with her again? Because that was my communication with my mom. We laughed, and she had surgery, and I got to get there, and I got to laugh with her one more time. And all of these things I talk about are just gifts of sobriety. I'm so happy to be here. I am so humbled to be your speaker tonight, and I want to thank you for letting me share.